This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
This week marks a turning point for the financial markets. The Fed raised interest rates for the second time this year. They admitted easy money language in their minutes and said they're leaning now against the economy. The ECB also ended taper, leaving interest rates negative until next year, and the Bank of Japan did absolutely nothing. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in Hour 1, Ari Wald from Oppenheimer will be joining me. He's saying the U.S. is the best place to be if you're investing in stocks. The dollar is starting to hurt international markets. We'll have more to say about that. In the big picture, small caps are leading the market. Much of that is reflected as a result of a rising dollar, which hurts the big multinational companies. And this is turning into a stock picker's market, according to Ari. And some good news if you are a homeowner. Joining me later on in the program will be Molly Bessel from CoreLogic. She's saying homeowners' equity in the U.S. increased by $1 trillion last year. That's an average of $16,300 per homeowner. For Californians, it was over $50,000. The lack of supply is leading to higher prices. They expect another 6% appreciation in real estate this year, and mortgage rates could be heading up to 6% by next year. And of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets that week. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, everybody seemed to be focused on events in Singapore with the summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un from North Korea. But actually, in Washington and in Europe, there were bigger events taking place that garnered little attention, notably, especially the press conference accompanying the Fed's Open Market Committee meeting. They said some very, very important things as to how they were going to raise rates and what they were going to do in the future. Now the question is, how high will they go with rates? They just said 4 raises instead of 3, and indicating more later on. And where will all of this wind up? You can already see the cracks developing in the emerging markets and in other countries such as Argentina and Italy and Brazil overseas. Very important to examine what happened at the press conference. There were some very important things that were communicated, and that will be the subject of the big picture today right here on the Financial Sense News Hour. And here we go, where we always do at the beginning of every single weekend. It's time to talk about the news, catalysts, and drivers that move the market this week with Ryan Poplava. And Ryan, I think probably I'm going to ask, what did you think of all the central bank meetings this week? Were these decisions something that you expected, or did you see any little rogue hits come out of somewhere you didn't expect?
We did, John. A lot of it we did expect, and we talked about some of the issues last week about essentially the European Central Bank officials. Their meeting being the real key event this week, that officials last week commented from like Peter Praet that this week the council would have to assess whether progress so far has been sufficient to warrant a gradual unwinding of their net purchases. So we knew coming in, this was a week that was a live meeting in which possibly policy changes would be discussed, and especially around tapering. And what was interesting is that they did the very thing we assumed they would. Given all that chatter last week, they announced a plan to cut their program of purchases from 30 billion euros down to 15 a month, and starting in September, and would end completely in December. So they gave us the beginning of their cutoff and when it was going to finish. But they ended with a caveat that it was subject to incoming data confirming the council's medium-term inflation outlook. So if inflation did start to drop off from their target, they could extend the purchases past December. So that was an interesting twist. And this is the first time that we got kind of some comment and focus that was calendar-based from the ECB. And so that was number one. The second big ticket item was the announcement they plan to keep rates at the present levels through the summer of 2019. And for as long as necessary to make sure inflation remains aligned with the current expectations of a sustained adjustment path. So that was the comment. And it kind of following the path the Fed essentially laid out many years ago when we started tapering our purchases and then we transitioned to raising rates. So it was a step-by-step baby steps to normalizing the process. So when Draghi was asked whether through the summer really meant September next year. At the meeting, Draghi said, if it meant September, it would have said September. Very literal. But tapering first and then raising rates after. And the choice was intentionally left as not very precise. So obviously this is a moving target. It'll be data dependent for them. So while they were removing accommodation with their taper plans, they also laid out what many felt was a dovish calendar-based guidance, which is really out of the norm for the ECB. So these actions had immediate effect on the markets, with the euro tumbling down almost 2%. The dollar rose quite a bit, and I think a point on the dollar index. And the largest decline for the currency, for the euro, this was the largest decline since the Brexit vote. So just to give you some scope here. Meanwhile, stocks rallied big time because, again, this was a dovish message that typically is looked at very lightly for stocks. And so the stocks 600 rallied 2.17% intraday, closing up 1.22% on the day. The 10-year bonds, that's the German government bonds, yield dropped from initially 0.509%, initially about, you know, 0.5% on the taper headlines, and then it dropped off as the bonds rallied. Yields dropped down to 0.424%. Draghi also mentioned the decision was unanimous, which was very interesting given that there are hawks there, just as there are hawks on our board here, which want to see policy normalize a little faster. But the decision was unanimous to put this calendar-like system ahead of us.
Yeah, and what's happening here, Ryan, is obviously they're following the U.S.'s lead in the accommodation glide path, but the timeline is so behind when the U.S. started to taper. I mean, it was 4.5 years ago when the Fed ended QE3, and it's still in the process of tapering with the allowance of maturities to roll off its balance sheet. So, and also, it just wasn't the European Central Bank that announced this week, but also the Federal Reserve, that's here, the Bank of Japan. And we know the Fed raised interest rates a quarter of a point, but it was said this meeting was hawkish because of their increased projections for the economy and rates. So is that a correct assessment? And how did it affect the markets?
Yeah, John, every quarter, the Fed officials give their projections for many of the things, including growth and where they expect the Fed funds rate. They call it the dot plot. And given where things were this current year, they also project where things will be next year. And then they also give their long-term targets. So yes, their update came and it was above expectations. I mean, we all knew that the Fed was going to raise interest rates. The probability was 100%, I think, like a month ago. And so what came out was the dot plot, which is what the Fed officials envision where we could see rate hikes the rest of the year. Are we only seeing one more, maybe in December or September, or potentially two more? And that's what we got. We got that instead of three rate hikes this year, they are envisioning four. So that means September and December are both possible meetings for rate hikes. Interestingly, Powell said that next year, every Fed meeting will be followed by a press conference, which also sets the stage that policy decisions can be made at any Fed meeting. They could now, but that hasn't been the norm. That hasn't been what's been typical. Wall Street, we've all been accustomed to big decision moves on dates that we have these press conferences. So that's what we've typically had. So that leads every meeting next year could be potentially what we call a live meeting. So very interesting. And in this meeting during the week, Powell gave a hat tip towards the yield curve. He mentioned it slightly, saying that it's something people are talking a lot about. And I think there should be, because, and I've been talking about this, many other Fed officials have been talking about it over the past few weeks. As I mentioned, Bullard had an interview a couple of weeks ago, and he really focused on this. He's been focusing on it since December of last year. And the reason being, the 2 to 10 year spread on the Treasury yield fell below 40 basis points for the first time since September 2007 this week. So the yield curve is flat, flatter than a pancake. And that's been the case all year, even more so. I don't know what's flatter than a pancake. Now, what are we going to talk paper? Stocks were volatile because of all these subtle adjustments that the Fed made, increasing the dot plot from 3 rate hikes to 4 this year, and then also the ECB with its 2 adjustments and very transparent plans for the near future. So stocks were pretty volatile. They ended up and down throughout that day when the Fed met, but ended off the day lower when the Wall Street Journal reported that Trump had plans to set forth his final list of tariffs, which he did pass. And that was for $50 billion on China. Essentially, Chinese have said that they have immediate retaliation plans. Real quickly, John, before we go into maybe the next section, another big focus, like you mentioned, the Bank of Japan, they left rates steady, but softened their view on core inflation to growth of nearly half to maybe 1% this year versus simply just 1%. So didn't really cause a lot of ruffles in the market. That was really the Fed and the ECB.
Yeah, if you really want to see flat, there's a process called nucleation where, you know, single layer atom substrates on things. And that's really flat. So even flatter than pancakes, I have to say it. All right. So that's Bank Week in finance. The Discovery Channel has Shark Week. We got Bank Week because we like money. What if you could call it swimming with banks? All right. Well, we'll see that. President Trump spoke with North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, and formed a pact to commit to the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula with a Chinese to support to revise sanctions. Of course, the media have just been awash in speculations and reservations about the whole thing. And really, it's a work in process. Sure. We're not going to know what comes out of it till later. It's really an interesting, odd world because, you know, President Trump operates like a businessman rather than a politician. There was a couple of articles that have come out pointing out his differences in style. But on one hand, he calls Kim a talented man and a worthy negotiator, while in the same week calling a neighbor to the North, Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, meek and mild and dishonest and weak.
So, does that sound like a businessman?
Well, it is how he does business. There was a terrific article written by Daniel Greenfield. This just came out yesterday or so, and understanding President Trump. And he said his method is very simple. And if you understand it, then you understand what he's doing and why he does it. It was like this morning, he suddenly pops up. And remember the Fox and Friends, did you see that on Friday morning? And they're doing a stand up from outside the White House, and who barges into the whole thing but President Trump. And so one of his whole techniques is unpredictability.
Yeah.
And he continues to show that. So anyway, and then there's all this flap going on about free trade and who's going to put what tariffs off. And everybody's really nervous about that.
Full trade, he called
it. Exactly. And that's all going to settle out, too, at some point or another. The rhetoric dies down and then you work a deal. But did it affect the market at all? Because last year there was a hiccup a few times, you remember, when it seemed like threats were escalating between President Trump and Kim Jong-un.
Yeah, and that seems to be the case this week with the G6 plus one. That was the U.S. of last weekend. And there's tit for tat going across tweets between the two. We talked about a little bit last week, but overall, not really. There are definitely huge political rifts that are forming between our allies and over essentially trade, which has been the subject of our podcast for many occasions so far this year, because it's a very key item. It's economic. It's not just political. IMF Lagarde warns it's a growing global risk. And Merkel said the EU retaliatory tariffs against the US are ready and can take effect after July 1st. So the market doesn't know what effect that announcement is really going to have on what they target. We've got individual markets within markets. So if they target food, you know, we can see food prices rise. If they target metals, we see metal prices rise. If they target lumber, et cetera. So that's not priced in just yet. All the negotiations, obviously the investors are really taking in stride. The market didn't get dumped on when some of these Wall Street articles hit about the tariffs, etc. We're starting to get, I wouldn't say numb, but kind of accustomed to the back and forth. The only other new item I would say this week that was important was the continued volatility in emerging market currencies. And we've covered it on the weekly podcast here a few times, but you really have to take a look at it this week just due to the central banks. Whenever the Fed begins raising rates and the dollar strength strengthens, currencies pegged to the dollar often see major disruptions. And that can sometimes pave the way for a currency crisis. Look at the Asian currency crisis in the late 90s, several peso crises in the 90s. EM currencies have essentially helped lead risk at the beginning of the week with a rally. The Brazilian real saw its biggest gain since 2015. It was up around 5%. but ended the week lower on some of these issues, with the Fed being hawkish and the ECB being dovish, and what that did to currencies, the euro plunging and the dollar rallying very strongly. The Argentino peso fell about 6.5% versus the dollar on Thursday, which caused the finance minister there to stabilize the currency with $7.5 billion to intervene. So far, we've seen these one-off events. There's been a lot of intervention by emerging market treasuries and central banks raising rates to stem off and strengthen their currencies versus, you know, some of these major sell-offs. So we do have some disruptions going on. There's so far, they've been very contained in the sense that they're not having very widespread disruptive qualities yet, but it's definitely something that we need to continue to monitor here.
And it is going to be interesting. A lot of this stuff is ongoing, and there's a move, and much of it rides on speculation. But I guess that's the way the markets move. A lot of it's emotional and psychological. All right, Ryan, see where we are next week. I appreciate it. Ryan Poplavas, good to hear from you again.
Sure then, John. See you next week.
Interest rates are rising, and the Fed intends to raise interest rates even further. As rates rise, the value of your bond funds will fall. Are you prepared for the next bond bear market? It has been almost 36 years since we've seen the last, and there's a high probability that another bear market in bonds has just begun. Long-term interest rates have been rising steadily since last fall. It's time to think about protecting capital. That's where Financial Sense Advisors can help you. Protect capital by designing a customized portfolio that can provide you with predictable income. Don't put your hard-earned wealth at risk. Call us today.
So give us a call at Financial Sense Advisors. As investment fiduciaries, we put your interest first. Let us help you design a portfolio that provides predictable income and protects your capital. Call now, toll free, 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939 to let us help you design a portfolio providing predictable income and protecting your capital. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. You know, Financial Sense NewsHour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense NewsHour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
I think the important thing to frame here when we're looking at how the world is shaping up is just to recognize we are back in this great power competition. And it's not something that I think a lot of people have fully wrapped their heads around, but it's happening. It's been a while since the U.S. has faced peer or near peer competitors, but it's a dynamic in which the U.S. on the one side is facing China, which is a strategic adversary in many respects, but also Russia trying to ride the coattails of China in a weaker position, but still has a lot of influence to wield in a lot of thorny foreign policy areas where the U.S. is heavily involved. And so with that in mind, the focus on China is really key. There's, of course, a big economic agenda there. And this is where we see things like the Section 301 tariff threat against China. We are days away from seeing whether the White House actually follows through with that threat. The rumor is that the White House is probably going to scope down the list of Chinese goods it wants to place tariffs on, with a focus on China's Made in 2025 initiative. So areas where the U.S. wants to undermine China's competitiveness in sensitive technologies, whether we're talking biotech, whether we're talking AI, robotics.
Well, the best thing you can say about the market is stocks are still in positive territory, from blue chips to small caps to mid caps. And the big industrial stocks are underperforming the smaller stocks. What does all that mean? Joining us on the program is Ari Wald from Oppenheimer. Ari, let's talk about some of the small cap indexes, whether you're looking at the Russell 2000, the mid cap or small cap within the S&P or the NASDAQ. I mean, that's clearly where the performance has been this year compared to the Dow, which has been lagging. I wonder if we could begin with that.
Of course, Jim, and I think what you hit on is not only is the smaller stocks of the market, but really the average stock is doing much better than the headline indexes suggest, that the market of stocks is acting better than the stock market. And we think that's a key positive for the bull cycle, and I think it argues for a continuation of the longer-term advance that we think is still intact. Indeed, our favorite area of the market is small-cap growth specifically. When talking about small-caps and the Russell 2000, what's notable to us is how well they held up through the volatility in the first quarter. And now that they are the area of the market that's really leading the broad market higher, that they were first to break out to the upside, first to break above their January peak, we see that as a sign of relative strength. We think they have a great deal of momentum behind it. They score best in a lot of our momentum work. And I think it's the area of the market where investors should continue to key on and where they want to be exposed to.
Ari, how much of this do you think is reflected in that the smaller caps tend to be more domestic oriented? I mean, if you're an S&P 500 company or Dow, 40% of your sales and revenues come from overseas. And with the rising dollar, that means less profit margin or less sales. How much of this is reflective of what's going on with the dollar, do you think?
I think a very big part of it. I think the strength we've seen in the dollar, specifically the strength since April, which reversed the prior one-year downtrend that the dollar had been in, coincided almost perfectly with the rotation into small caps. So I think that's exactly what's going on, that a stronger dollar tends to be less of a headwind for small cap stocks due to their lower multinational exposure. And I think this strong dollar that we're seeing is going to continue to help support leadership by small caps.
So if you expect small caps as to be the leaders and that to continue, I want to talk about something that happened this week. The Fed had a press conference and the dot plot moved from 3 hikes this year. It looks like they're talking about 4 rate hikes. Let's talk about the impact on financials.
For financials, I think that's another area where you're really seeing the resiliency in the U.S.-focused part of the sector. I mean, when talking about the geopolitical volatility that we've seen, it's really representative of what's been a major breakdown in the European financials. It's hit some of the large cap money centers due to their more global exposure, but then you have a lot of the smaller regional financials holding up much better. So overall, we do think financials can continue to work over a longer term period. They're our favorite way to gain exposure to the more value-oriented sectors of the market. But as you speak about the Fed and the reaction that we're seeing in the market, we think it argues for growth investing, that the outperformance that we've seen in growth should continue based on the implications from the current trajectory of the Fed. What's interesting to us is that we've seen a much more muted reaction the long end of the yield curve following the Fed announcement. The 10-year U.S. Treasury yield is pushed up to a very important level of 3.05%. This was the peak in the 10-year dating back to late 2013, essentially the taper tantrum peak. Now, as we've hit this resistance, we're seeing some moderation in the 10-year. It hasn't been able to push through. We've seen it start to lose some momentum. Some of our momentum indicators have begun to diverge. And I think in general, just given lower rates in overseas bond markets, that we continue to have this anchor at the long end of the yield curve. Now, at the same time, short end of the yield curve, which is the part of the yield curve that's more correlated to Fed policy, we think the short end continues to rise. And in turn, you're going to have a continued flattening in the yield curve. Now, if you look back at the relationship between the yield curve and the value versus growth relative relationship, it's been very closely correlated in recent years. So I think as long as you're making the case for a continued flatness in the yield curve, you're going to continue to see growth sectors like technology, consumer discretionary, and small cap healthcare in particular continue to outperform.
Let's talk about one of the implications of a rising dollar and rising interest rates here in the U.S., and that's the impact that we're starting to see on currencies in some of the emerging markets. Whether you look at the trouble in Brazil right now, Argentina, you have Turkey and other troubled spots. Recently, it was Italy. What about the impact on emerging markets and international markets?
The strength in the dollar is going to hurt a lot of investors that currently own dollar-denominated ETFs that track these overseas markets, both in developed overseas markets and emerging markets as well. I think that trend continues. What we've seen both in local currency terms and dollar-denominated terms is U.S. outperformance. And again, I think it argues for investing in the U.S. rather than in overseas equities. And I think the stronger dollar continues to weigh on emerging market performance. You see it in the iShares Emerging Market ETF, ticker EEM. Relative to the S&P 500, it's really started to break down and it's been underperforming versus the S&P. You've seen it in more developed overseas areas as well. Europe, for instance, showing a much bigger moderation in its trend, perhaps less so due to the dollar, more so due to the preference for growthier areas of the market, like technology. Very interesting to us is that technology is a 25% weighting in the S&P 500, only a 4% weighting in Europe. So as long as technology continues to outperform, I think the U.S. is going to continue to outperform Europe. And as long as the dollar continues to strengthen, we think the U.S. is going to continue to outperform versus emerging markets.
Ari, how much of this is also the changing shape of the U.S. economy? If you take a look at whether it's the FANG stocks or the technology sector like XLK, the performance of technology versus, let's say, the industrials, is that reflective of really what the U.S. economy is becoming? Is a more technologically driven economy than an industrial economy?
That's right. You know, through recent decades, the economy has shifted from a more manufacturing based to now services based. And you see it in the composition of the S&P 500 as well, with the technology sector making up 25% of the S&P 500. Really impressive.
So when you look at this, we're seeing strength in the small caps. We're seeing strength in technology. I want to talk about two other areas that are showing some promise, and that has been consumer discretionary. To me, with consumer discretionary stocks doing well, that's just reflective more of how well the economy is doing.
That's right. And it's not just cap-weighted consumer discretionary, which is dominated by tech related stocks like Amazon and Netflix, but equal weighted consumer discretionary as well has really marked a notable sign of improvement. Now, this is an area of the market that had been an underperformer for much of a 3-year period from 2015 to 2017 that is really taking a noticeable leg up here. The traditional retailing stocks in particular have been a big part of that. And again, I think that does support a continuation of the advance that we're seeing in U.S. equities, this preference for more cyclical areas of the market. While these consumer cyclicals have been leadership in 2018, on the flip side of that equation, more defensive countercyclical sectors with a high dividend like consumer staples have been an underperformer. So that's a key point for us, this healthy risk-on appetite, market preference for consumer cyclicals over consumer countercyclicals, I think is a key positive and argues for an extension of the advance that we're in.
I want to turn our attention to another asset class, and that is commodities. If you look at the price of oil, it hit almost $80 a barrel on West Texas. And there for a while, Ari, the energy stocks were lagging in the first part of the year, let's say in the first quarter, and then just took off like a rocket ship in April. They pulled back recently. What's your take on energy here?
Well, starting first with commodity prices, I do think the stronger dollar is going to have implications to that market. There tends to be an inverse relationship that tends to pressure commodities when you see a strong dollar. So I don't think we're in the same trending environment for commodity prices like we were in the prior decade from 2002 into 2008. Instead, we think commodities are going to be more range-bound in nature, faced with those headwinds from a stronger dollar that we're seeing. Now, in terms of the energy sector, we are seeing some pockets of strength. Again, giving mixed signals from the commodity markets, we're also seeing mixed signals within the energy sector. Particular areas of the sector have been acting strong, like refining stocks and oil exploration and production stocks as well. You're not seeing the same strength in the equipment names and some of the large cap integrated names with high dividends as well. So given that mixed evidence, I think you can be selective in terms of exposure to the energy sector. You want to own the E&P side rather than the services side.
Another commodity that seems to be at least holding its own, given the strength of the dollar, is gold. What's your take on gold here?
Gold has really felt the implications to the stronger dollar. It's been much more closely linked, where oil has held support through this upturn in the dollar. Gold has broken down. It's broken some support levels because it's got a dual headwind. One, the stronger dollar. Two, investors are selling safer areas of the market, and gold's traditionally viewed as a safe haven asset. So our take on gold is that there's cost opportunity here. We think gold is in this very long-term range. It could be this long-term bottoming pattern, but I think it's going to take time until you really see gold reassert itself to the upside. The key level on the upside has been 1400. The gold's just been stuck below there for years now. Every time you get close to that level and it looks like gold's going to break higher, it falls back down, whether it's because of the strong dollar more recently, whatever it might be. But we think that range-bound action is generally going to continue for the price of gold, and we see cost opportunity there. We'd rather be invested in U.S. equities.
In this kind of market where you're seeing divergent trends in the major indexes, as we began our conversation, the Dow is lagging, for example, the S&P, it's lagging the NASDAQ, it's lagging the Russell. And the reason I'm bringing that up is indexing has become very popular. The money going into index funds like the S&P, the spiders, and everything like that. Do you think this is a market as you go forward that is emphasizing growth? If you are an indexer, you better be in the right index.
I think that's true. I think as the age of the economic cycle continues to mature and we push into more late cycle conditions, we are acknowledging this is more late cycle. We're just saying late cycle is not end of cycle. What we're seeing is that underneath the surface, the market trends are becoming much more uncorrelated and bifurcated. And I think it really puts the emphasis on active selection here. And you're seeing that with the average stock acting better than the stock market, that this has become a market of stocks. Now more than ever, I think there's a lot of alpha to be generated by top-down selection and active selection overall, getting the right sector right, getting the right industry right. Because as those trends continue to become, again, more uncorrelated, I think that's where the money is to be made rather than at the index level.
And going back to the Fed meeting this week, where this week the Fed said, no, it looks like four times this year instead of three. Do you see anything on the horizon that would hold the market back or the impact of interest rates on the market? And that would be my first question. The second one, at what point do you think it's going to take before these hikes in interest rates? I mean, if they hike two more times this year, you may be getting 3% plus on two-year Treasury notes.
You know, the old Wall Street saying is don't fight the Fed. And now, of course, the Fed, while it is tightening here, if you look back historically, the overall market doesn't have issues until the curve inverts. Now, I know we're getting closer to an inversion of the yield curve, but we're not there yet. In fact, if you look at returns for the S&P 500 based on current levels of the yield curve, when you're at the point where you're flattening but still positive on the curve, you typically see terrific returns for the equity markets. That equities have done very well into an inversion. The inversion is the leading signal. So we remind investors, don't lead the leading indicator. I think once we do get the inversion in the yield curve, at that point, we can make the case that there's some troubles on the horizon. At that point, we're going to be looking at our internal breathwork to suggest that a market top might be in. Typically, breadth indicators like the New York Stock Exchange Advanced Decline Line will peak ahead of the S&P 500, that you'll see a narrowing of participation at a market top. And right now, we're not seeing that yet. With the Advanced Decline Line at a new high, with small caps at a new high, we think this argues against a market top. Without the inversion in the yield curve, we think it argues for below average recession risks. So when you add it all up, yes, we're late cycle, but late cycle doesn't mean end of cycle.
So I guess from an investor point of view, there's been a lot of investors that have stayed out of this market. Some have come back in recently. If you were putting new money to work right now, where would you put it?
Our top theme is U.S. small cap growth. Now, there's an ETF that tracks that theme. It's the iShares Russell 2000 Growth ETF. It's ticker IWO. If you look at the construction of this ETF, 50% of it is technology and healthcare, 25-25. So those are the sectors that we'd be interested in as well, looking at technology, at small cap healthcare, looking at the consumer discretionary sector that is really just starting to reassert itself after a couple years of underperformance. For exposure to the value factor, if you're looking to put together a more diversified portfolio, we'd look at the financial sector, and an ETF like the iShares Broker Dealer and Security Exchange ETF, ticker IAI. So I think these rotations are going to continue to develop. I think it's going to lead to an extension of the bull market. I think investors have to participate right here. And I think exposure to stocks is warranted. We'd be putting money to work in those more cyclical areas of the market.
Yeah, you mentioned consumer discretionary, and it's just amazing. If you look at some of these retail stocks, one that came to mind was Macy's. Here's a stock that was selling at $18 last Christmas season, and today it's at $37. So, I mean, this stock has more than gone up 100%.
Indeed, and still well below its prior highs. What's amazing, through this reversal in the retailing group, you also have instances where the leaders continue to lead on the way up. A stock like Home Depot that bucked the weakness in the retail group while the rest of the industry was going down, Home Depot was still going up. And as the entire group reverses as well, Home Depot continues to participate. So again, a great example of keying on leadership, buying momentum. We're momentum investors. It's been one of the best performing factors through the market cycles over recent decades. And that's our way of investing. We think buying momentum is a terrific course of action.
Great advice. Ari, if our listeners like to follow your work, tell them how they could do so, please.
They can follow me on Twitter. My handle is my name. It's at Ari Wald.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
According to this framework, we're nearing the end of a secular move. So after this, I wouldn't be surprised if we move into a decade that's more similar as far as returns to the 70s, where inflation's going to become more likely and on average stocks aren't going to return that much over the long haul. But over the shorter term, as far as this cycle goes, I'm in the camp that the cycle is going to continue longer than what most people think. So a lot of people have been calling for bear market and recession, you know, every year for the last few years. I think that there's a good chance that liquidity globally remains relatively flush and supportive, but we're going to see more volatility, especially in emerging markets, but that U.S. assets is going to continue to get this persistent bid from these capital inflows, and that's going to drive up prices. I wouldn't be surprised if we see a melt-up scenario over the next 1 to 2 years.
Joining me next on the program is Chris Sheridan. He's editor of FS Insider in quite a lineup of guests this week. Chris, you covered the gamut from the economy, the summit this week in Singapore, along with change in weather that could alter weather patterns. So why don't we begin with your lineup this week, which I found rather interesting.
Yeah, Jim, thanks. We first spoke with James Garris at the Browning World Climate Bulletin, and it was really interesting because the last time that we spoke with James was in December 2017. And at the time, we had talked about how they believe destructive weather phenomenon are going to continue to increase. A large part of that had to do with what he referred to as mesoscale convective systems and some other factors that they're looking at. But in any case, one of the interesting things from that discussion that we had in December was how volcanoes impact the climate. And lo and behold, this year we saw the two major volcanic eruptions that took place, and they were quite devastating, of course. So I wanted to bring them back on to talk about, hey, you know, we were talking about this in 2017, and here we go. This is as it happened. How did you know? Or what were some of the impacts that we've seen now and tying in the destruction that we've seen? It's interesting because I remember kind of reminded me when you had Kevin Mazzucato on, I think it was in 2016, right before the major hurricane season that kicked up, and you guys talked about preparing for disaster. And if you remember, that podcast took place right before we saw one of the most destructive hurricane seasons on record. Obviously, we didn't plan that, but it just happened to work out well for listeners that were in Florida and parts of the country that were affected. So that's kind of what took place again with the discussion on volcanoes. On Thursday, we talked with Alex Barrow at Macro Ops, and it was really interesting because I have yet to see any research that has been done to this extent yet on how supply and demand really impact the market. I know this is something that has come up with a lot of your guests and our guests on FS Insider in terms of how many shares there are available on the market, how fewer shares there are available now than there was in the past. And so with less supply and the same demand, that's driving prices higher. So he talked about that analysis. And actually, let's play the clip where he explains how this related to the mathematical certainty for the massive bull market that we saw in the 80s. And he'll explain that here for you.
You can take this model and look back over the last 30, 40 years, and it's done a really good job of predicting the larger secular trends. So looking back at the early 80s, investors' allocation to stocks was at an all-time secular low, at one point hitting roughly just 12% of their total portfolio mix. But there was also a large amount of money, of credit, being created, primarily because interest rates were falling. There was a lot of lending going on in the market. And so we actually had a secular high point in money creation. And then on top of that, we had more supply being taken off the market through corporate buybacks. So that created this gigantic supply-demand imbalance to where while everybody was bearish on stocks, it became a mathematical certainty that the stock market, the total market value, had to rise a lot for prices to be able to clear and for supply and demand to be able to balance.
Well, you know, it's interesting what he's talking about there, because one of the drivers of this bull market has been share buybacks. In fact, we're going to talk about this in the big picture today, that this year alone, we have hit $2 trillion in share buybacks and M&A activity, a record bigger than where we were in the year 2000, just as the market peaked, and bigger than where we were in 2007. So it's not surprising to hear him talk about that. I want to go on to another guest you had this week, which is Ariva Gujan from Stratfor, especially with the summit that took place in Singapore. What did she have to say about that? How significant is this? And does Stratfor expect that Trump will achieve his objectives of denuclearization of North Korea?
Yeah, so that was a really interesting interview that we had. And Stratfor has been talking about keeping an open mind over the talks between Trump and Kim Jong-un, that even there was a lot of rhetoric that's taking place. I mean, there was threats of nuking one another on both sides, of course. So, you know, the rhetoric was quite heated. But the thing that Stratfor has been saying in their forecast for quite some time is that keep an open mind that, yes, they're going to say this and try to appease their population on the one hand for, you know, being the strong leaders that they want to appear as. On the other hand, Trump is going to probably try to be more pragmatic on this, and that there's a lot that Kim Jong-un could also achieve on his end, especially since their economy is just doing terrible. So that's how they've been approaching it. And definitely they've been right. Their forecasts have been correct. So we got an update from Riva on Friday to discuss this a little bit more fully and kind of what they think is going to happen going forward. Let's go ahead and play that clip and hear what she had to say.
This meeting was absolutely important. Of course, here comes the hard part. When we talk about denuclearization, at what pace, on what timeline, the verification aspect of this, is North Korea really going to come through and disclosing all of its nuclear assets? Is it going to open itself to outside inspectors? There are going to be hurdles. There will be drama. You will see walkouts. It's going to appear like the negotiations falling apart at multiple points. But I think we're at a very important starting point, at least in demonstrating the political will for an agreement moving forward.
So if this does take place and they get rid of their nuclear weapons, you wonder if the next thing will be unification of North and South Korea. This is, at least on the geopolitical front, a major move. It'll be interesting to see how this turns out. Anything else coming up in the weeks ahead, Chris?
Yeah, we've got quite a lineup. We're trying to get Gary Schilling solidified for next week, so look forward to seeing that interview. Of course, you'll be speaking with him, Jim, on his recent Insight newsletter, and then we've got another few big-name guests that we're also working on to bring on to FS Insider as well. And then also, you know, with both Alex Barrow and the Riva Gujan interviews that we conducted this week, there was a lot that we discussed that went outside of just the clips. I mean, Alex explained that if we look at the supply-demand calculation that you can use to determine both secular ups and downs in the market, there's a lot that we can say and infer about today's market when we use that. So it's quite different than what we saw in the 80s. So you definitely want to hear what he had to say. And then also what Riva had elaborated on was really the big news that came out this week with US and China trade disputes, the Friday markets falling, of course, based on the fact that there was more tariffs being slapped. I know Ryan mentioned that a bit in the wrap up today, but we talked about how a lot of this is centering on the Made in China 2025 initiative. And a lot of it goes back to something that we've been discussing on FS Insider with other guests, that there's definitely an arms race between the US and China over key sensitive technologies. And so we went into that with Riva when it comes to, you know, biotechnology, artificial intelligence, robotics, a number of different areas that both countries are really trying to gain a leading edge on. So lots of interesting stuff that's going on really behind the scenes under the surface that isn't necessarily getting to the mainstream news that we've been digging into. So I definitely want to encourage any of you that haven't listened to those to do so. And again, if you'd like to ever sign up for a free trial, you can do so. You can email me at cris@financialsense.com. I can send you the link to that. Or if you want to just go right to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe now banner, you can definitely sign up that way as well.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
There's some good news if you're a homeowner. The value of real estate in this country is up over $1 trillion since the first quarter of 2017. And as a nation, the net worth of America has approached $100 trillion. Much of that gain in net worth is not just the stock market, it's real estate. Joining us from CoreLogic is Molly Bezel. Molly, you guys have been putting out a home equity report going back to, 2009. You just published one, and there's some good news here for homeowners. Let's talk about the year-over-year increase in the value of homes just in the last 12 months.
Yeah, nationwide, borrower equity has increased by over $1 trillion, and that's looking from March 2017 to March 2018. The increase in home prices we've seen over the past few years, and specifically over the past year, has really driven that increase in home equity.
Now, when you say in your report, roughly 63% in your report is people that have mortgages, which is about 63% of the market, have seen their equity increase 13.3% over, let's say, last year. Are you finding that when you say it's nationally, are there any areas that stand out? In other words, is the West growing faster than the East, or is it just somewhat of an average composite? Any area growing faster?
Well, when we talk about that $1 trillion, of course, that's for the whole nation. If we want to boil that down to what we'd say for the average borrower has gained $16,300 in equity over just the last year. Now, as you mentioned, you know, there are probably some areas of the country that are doing even better than that. And those are the areas of the country that are growing faster and are more expensive. For example, California borrowers gained an average of $50,900 over the last year.
Wow.
And borrowers in Washington State gained an average of $43,700. So quite a bit more than the average borrower.
Are you finding something like in terms of affordability? Because I know when you take a look at what is affordable in California, you have to put that in perspective to everybody else, because homes in what, San Francisco, are over $1 million, the median price home. I know in Orange County, even in San Diego, we have a joke. California's definition of a millionaire is a homeowner.
Yeah, that's right. Affordability is becoming an issue for people looking to get into home ownership. And, you know, one of the things that's causing this problem is a lack of supply. And that lack of supply is pushing up prices. We find prices increasing even faster on the lower end. So those would be more affordable properties. So there is a tough market out there for borrowers.
You know, this is something that I found rather fascinating and surprising. Unlike the housing bust in the last decade, in this recovery, there's been a shortage of supply, not only of homes, of workers, and things of that nature. And you would think after, what, 8 or 9 years into this recovery, that would have been resolved. What's behind that? Is it because the loss of workers during the economic downturn, there are just not enough people that returned back to the industry?
Well, one of the issues is there hasn't been enough new construction to make up the difference in supply. It could be the lack of workers. Land prices are very expensive. Builders might be able to acquire land, but at very high prices, which, you know, would affect the affordability of the properties they're building.
So when you take a look at this affordability, is there anything that stands out in your report, other than the fact that, let's say, you know, home equity increased by $1 trillion, that averages about 13.3% or $16,000. That's a lot of money. Is this last year any different than, let's say, the years before it that preceded it?
Home equity has really started to ramp up probably over about the last 5 years. When we started this report in 2009, that was at a period of time when, you know, we were talking about negative equity. Negative equity back then was at about 26% of all borrowers were in negative equity. Now we're down to under 5%. And this increase in prices, particularly since around 2012 until now, has really brought borrowers out of that negative equity position. Over about the past 5 years, home equity has more than doubled. So this is something that's been, you know, kind of quietly going on now for about 5 years or so.
I wonder if you could talk about some of these areas with negative equity, because it's really surprising. For example, Miami Beach area in, let's say, Florida. I would have thought that the recovery would have been much greater there because the prices got to be so low.
Yeah, so some of the areas that are still have fairly high negative equity are parts of the country that were particularly hard hit during the housing crisis. You bring up Miami, Florida. That was one of the hardest areas hit during the housing crash. So they have, you know, come back quite a bit from the peak of that negative equity position. But as you mentioned, 12% of outstanding mortgages are in negative equity. One area of the country I really like to point out is Nevada. In the peak of negative equity, Nevada had almost 73% of loans in negative equity. You know, that's a pretty incredible number to think about. And in our last report, negative equity in Nevada was 6.8 8%. So they've made great improvements in their equity position in Nevada.
And when you're looking at areas like that surprises me, Los Angeles, Long Beach, Denver, Houston, and New York, Jersey City.
Mm-hmm. Well, San Francisco, Denver, Houston, Los Angeles have had very high home prices, so their equity positions are going to be pretty good. Then some of the areas of the country that are just about recovered or recently recovered from the housing crisis, you know, might have a worse equity position than you would expect. But prices are still continuing to go up all across the country. So we expect these trends that we are seeing in our recent report to continue at least in the near term.
And once again, the reason for much of that is just what? A lack of supply?
Lack of supply in housing available for sale and very high demand for housing.
Now, what about first-time home buyers? When this recovery began, there was questions about, let's say, millennials who did not have jobs and just didn't have the net worth or the down payment to get into homes because they had student loans. Have you seen a change in, let's say, what we call first-time home buyers?
So we don't track the first-time home buyers specifically, but if you do look at the age distribution of the U.S., millennials are beginning to get into their peak home buying years. So their sheer numbers of millennials will be creating a huge demand for home ownership.
It's my understanding the millennials now in terms of population are bigger than the boomers. And I know when the boomers were going through the housing market, they drove housing up as they started families. Do you see the same thing happening with millennials?
Yeah, exactly. We would expect the same trends with millennials. Perhaps maybe the trends could be delayed by a few years, you know, because a lot of them did suffer through the Great Recession. They may need time to build up reserves from that, but we do expect to see very similar trends to boomers.
Now, the Fed raised interest rates this week. We've got mortgage rates at probably the highest levels they've been in 5 or 6 years. Do you see that slowing down the housing market as mortgages rise and we start approaching, let's say, 5% on a mortgage, which, you know, for somebody that was a boomer, getting a 5% mortgage, I can remember my first mortgage was 12%. So 5% still sounds like a deal.
Yeah, 5% mortgage is still a really good deal. And, you know, we might see the increase in mortgage rates cut into affordability a little bit. So maybe it's harder for someone to afford the payment. So we expect a little bit of a decrease in home buying due to mortgage rates. But again, demand for home buying is very high right now, and I don't expect it to be too much of a problem.
So as you see things the way they're playing out right now, average equity is going up. You see that trend continuing, the lack of supply. Prices are really moving up on the lower end. Is that because this new group, let's say the millennials, is coming into the market? These are starter homes. If there was to be a bottleneck or shortage, would that be the low end of the market?
Oh, certainly. We find that the lower end of the market has much lower supply than the higher end of the market. And that's where a lot of the demand is right now.
In this recovery, what about McMansions? In the last recovery, that was one thing. People were trading up and they called them McMansions. The size of the home was getting bigger. The average square footage went from, what was it, 1,800, 2,000. It got up to 3,000 or even more. Are you seeing McMansions sell?
We do see that the higher priced homes are selling. They do have much higher supply, though, in the higher priced homes, but they are still selling.
The Wall Street Journal publishes mansion reports, and you just hear about, you know, these celebrities putting their homes on the market. It figures one can only imagine. They sound more like palaces at $28 million, $50 million, and things like that. But the average home, what is the mean average home price in this country right now?
The average home price is down in the 200,000. So, you know, when you look at those prices up in the, you know, multi-million dollar homes, that's a very small share of what's out there.
In 200,000, can you still find that in California?
Oh, I doubt it. The average home prices in California are much higher. As you mentioned at the beginning, in, you know, places like San Francisco, it's well over $1 million.
So as you look at the housing market, do you see any area of the country that maybe you would define as a bubble? The one area that stands out to me in terms of almost bubble-like qualities is San Francisco. When you look at, what is it, the mean price is something like $1.3 million?
We do track what we call overvalued areas of the country. Interestingly enough, when you look at the incomes of people buying in San Francisco, they're high enough to sustain those high prices. So, you know, maybe San Francisco is not overvalued because the incomes in that area are high enough to sustain those prices.
I guess if you work for Google or Apple or somebody like that, you're probably making several hundred thousand dollars a year. So maybe you can afford a house like that. In terms of the rest of the country, though, the average price, I suspect, Molly, if you went to the Midwest, if you went to Iowa, Missouri, or someplace like that, that's where you're going to find homes, or Indiana, for several hundred thousand versus, let's say, the prices on the West Coast or on the East Coast, because beach communities or on the ocean properties tend to be more expensive.
Yeah, that's right. The coasts do tend to have the higher prices.
So when you look at this going forward, how long can you see this lasting? Because yesterday in the press conference that Fed Chairman Powell gave, he basically said, look, instead of going three times this year, we're probably going to go four, and we can see maybe three rate increases next year. At some point, there's got to be a level of a rise in interest rates where it really starts to impact the housing market.
When I look at interest rate forecasts, they really are coming in definitely under 6% even through the end of next year. So while we do expect to see a fairly big increase from where they are now, mortgage rates are still going to remain pretty low.
So in terms of looking at a house, if you were advising, let's say, a young couple, they finally maybe have enough money for a down payment on a house, even though we're raising interest rates and you expect prices to go higher, you would tell them what, to buy a house right now?
You know, I don't like to get into giving advice, but I wouldn't want anyone to rush into anything, you know, if they weren't in a position to be able to afford that and make the payments going forward.
But given that we've seen, what, increase in equity of $16,300, increase of $1 trillion, increase in net worth in real estate, you still expect that trend to continue?
We do expect home prices to continue to go up, probably in about 5-6% over the next year. So yeah, we do expect the equity to continue to increase. That will help the current borrowers in increasing their balance sheets. But, you know, as we've been talking about, if someone is not yet a homeowner, they will get left out of that.
Well, it's doing a lot better than the stock market right now, which is probably one reason why America's net worth is increasing. Because as the Wall Street Journal talked about, nearly an increase of $100 trillion is the net worth of this country. And they attribute most of that coming from the real estate market in the last couple of years. Molly, as we close, any other advice? Is this still a good time for a real estate investment? I know you don't like to give advice, but you're saying here that this trend of 5-6% price increases should continue in the foreseeable future.
You know, people know their own local markets, and, you know, they'd be a good judge of when it's a good time to get in or not. But we do see prices in the short term continuing to go up.
Well, some good news if you're a homeowner. Your home is going up in value. And even though there's a couple places around the country that have negative equity, it's still improving. Molly, thanks so much for joining us on the program. Really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Media this week seemed focused on the significance of what was going on in Singapore, the summit meeting between President Trump and Kim Jong-un, leader of North Korea. But actually in Washington and Europe, there were much larger events taking place that gained very little attention, but will affect the markets in months and years ahead. Notably, the press conference accompanying the Fed's Open Market Committee meeting this week. But now the question is, how high will they raise interest rates? They just said 4 instead of 3, and indicating more later on. Where is all of this going to wind up? That's the subject of conversation coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertised with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.